This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you live from the Stanford campus. If I were to say there are cities that well up from the unconscious, or that some cities are sworn to secrecy, or that every city has a distinct timbre to its noise quotient, or that some cities laugh while others bleed, some profess, others chant, some stutter, some bellow, some exhort, and others wail. Or if I were to quote Invisible Cities, where Italo Calvino says, "Arriving at each new city, the traveler finds again a past of his that he did not know he had." Or if I were to affirm that the reality of a city resides in its imagination, that its waking life hovers on the surface of a dream, none of this, remarkably enough, would get us anywhere. It might not get us anywhere, but before you get somewhere, you have to get ready to go, and that's what we're doing now, getting ready to go. Where to? To Paris, mes amis. Paris. To visit the American writers who lived or sojourned there during the 20th century. I have a guest with me in the studio, Cécile Alduy, who is uniquely qualified to serve as our guide on this pilgrimage. But before I introduce her to you, let me throw out one of my innocuous, entitled opinions, to the effect that Paris is the one European city where the American soul, if there is such a thing as the American soul, and I believe there is least likely to recognize itself. In fact, this irreducible dissimilarity may be exactly why so many American writers went to Paris at critical junctures in their careers. Here's how I see it. The American soul is fundamentally wild, isolationist, not quite at home in the world. Its true homeland is some impossible place beyond society, beyond language, beyond the law, perhaps even beyond the body. Proudly inarticulate when it comes to expressing what moves and matters to it, the American soul is pledged to its native aphasia. So much so that, at its best, modern American literature gives voice to this aphasia and renders it eloquent instead of overcoming it. But Paris, ah well, Paris is the most articulate city in the world. It masters all forms of expression and is completely bien dans sa peau, or at home in its skin, as the French say. Nothing could be further removed from the American way of being than being bien dans sa peau, which is why we Americans have an irrepressible need to jump out of our skins from time to time, usually with the aid of spirits or psychotropes of some sort, or else with the aid of preachers, healers, fantasticators, or firearms. Paris. Paris. Parigi. The word itself is incantatory, evoking a host of accessory images and sentiments, even for people who have never been to the city. E.E. Cummings describes it best in his 1922 novel, The Enormous Room. As a crowded night train transporting prisoners of war and other unfortunates pulls into the station during wartime, quote, "Some permissionaries cried, 'Paris.' The woman across from me said, 'Paris, Paris. A great shout came up from every insane, drowsy brain that had traveled with us, a fierce and beautiful cry which went the length of the train. Paris, where one forgets, Paris, which is pleasure, Paris, in whom our souls live, Paris the beautiful, Paris enfin. Someone once said of Rome that it is an eternal idea in the mind of God. The same could never be said about Paris. Paris is consummately human. It's a garden where life in its human self-realizations blooms in primary colors, even under gray skies. E.E. Cummings again. Everywhere I sensed a miraculous presence of living beings, everyone alive, alive, alive. There are many places in the world where one senses an exuberant presence of life, but Paris conjugates life with form like nowhere else on earth. In Paris, the presence of life is never riotous, tropical, or overflowing, but always contained in a flowering multiplicity of forms. Forms that intensify life by bringing its mastered energies into the radiance of appearance. It is impossible in Paris not to feel that this is the one place that gets life right and maximizes its potential for being lived. Unlike the French, we Americans don't know what it's like to be uninhibited even as we submit to a regime of form. We're insufficiently humanized for that. We spend too much of our time either maintaining our inhibitions or looking for ways to shed them. But again, it's this quintessentially American ill-at-easeness in the world, and that means in the American homeland as well, which made Paris such an asylum for 20th century American writers, who were typically even more ill-at-ease in spirit than their compatriots. For these writers, Paris was anything but a mirror reflecting an image of themselves. It was the opposite of that. In Paris, they saw a city which, by contrast, put their own nation in sharp perspective and allowed them to take their distance from it. Nothing is more essential to American writers probing the murky depths of their own culture than gaining such distance. And it seems that Paris offered them just the right distance from America, neither too far nor too close. Of course, these are just my own breezy speculations. To find out what was really going on with American writers in Paris, we'll turn now to my guest Cécile Aldry, herself a Parisian, who teaches French literature here at Stanford. Cécile, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Robert.
I should mention that just this past fall, Cécile Aldry taught a course in Paris at the Stanford Center on American writers in Paris, which must have been quite a class. How did that course go, Cécile? Can you tell us what you did in it?
Yes, of course. It was wonderful because what we did was we used Paris as the classroom for the class. We had, of course, a serious syllabus with a list of American writers from Gertrude Stein up to Henry Miller, Fitzgerald, Henry Miller, Anais Nin, the Beat poets, and even a modern-day New Yorker, Adam Gopnik, who lived in Paris just a couple years ago. But what we really did was explore the relationship between the text and the place itself. So we spent a great deal of time actually going to the cafes and the streets and the bookstores where these writers got their liking for Paris and got their inspiration from. And I think the students also really liked the fact that I try to put them in the position of writers themselves.
Yeah, in what sense?
Well, among the so-called assignments they had to do were, for instance, to go spend an afternoon in a cafe and try to decipher what would be a good cafe to write, as Hemingway puts it in A Movable Feast. And they also were writing diaries, reporting on their experience of being abroad and feeling, at times, as you said, ill at ease with a place where they're outside of their comfort zone, basically, and what it meant for that sense of their self-identity as Americans.
Did they get a sense of what it must have been to be a writer in Paris? And the first thing, there's this whole idea that the cafe culture, that writers had to do all their writing in cafes. Do we know that this was more the norm than not the norm, that American writers would do a lot of their writing in cafes, actually?
I think that the mystic of the American writers in a cafe, you know, concentrating on his little paragraph while sipping a beer, comes mostly from Hemingway's A Movable Feast.
More than beer, no, with Hemingway?
Yeah, it depends what time during the day. In the morning, he starts with a real cafe and then very quickly switch to rum or cognac. But Gertrude Stein obviously was writing not that much, actually, like half an hour a day at home. And other writers, like Ezra Pound, were not writing in cafes at all. But there's the scene of the cafe, even if they were not writing there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Good. Well, there are successive generations of American writers. We're talking about the 20th century here, because we could also go back into the 19th and even into the 18th century. It would be fascinating. Maybe we can talk about how Jefferson and Franklin had had this very productive relationship with France. But concentrating on the 20th century, we have successive generations that go to Paris and do some of their most interesting creative work in the city. So why don't we enumerate, who does it start with?
I think for the 20th century, it really starts with Gertrude Stein, who leaves Oakland, not far from here, in 1903 to join her brother in Paris. And they live Rue de Fleurus, and that's just a parenthesis, the also great experience of teaching in Paris and for the students here to go in the overseas campus, that it's situated right at the heart of the American district in Montparnasse. So we are like one block from Rue de Fleurus, where Gertrude Stein had the most famous salon of the 20th century, basically. So she arrives at the beginning of the 20th century.
And Excuse me for interrupting. Did she have a specific motive for going to Paris originally?
Actually, to collect art. Her brother introduced her to do so. So she started collecting art with her brother, and the art she was collecting was mostly young painters that no one else wanted to buy, as Picasso and Matisse. So, of course, she had like a really interesting eye for art. The other reason for going to Paris, though, was that she discovered she could also have the personal life as a lesbian that she wanted to have and could not in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a second aspect that she doesn't talk about in her writings, but is appearing from her life.
Her salon was a welcoming place of not only for American writers, clearly, also for the French artistic scene at the avant-garde, no?
Completely avant-garde. She wanted to be seen as the mother of modernism. And in the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas that she wrote, although it's supposed to be written in the name of her companion, she says, speaking in the name of Alice, that she met three great geniuses, Picasso, Joyce, and Gertrude Stein. And, of course, people can disagree on the third one, but Gertrude Stein invited and sponsored, basically, all the painters, the cubist painters from Picasso to Braque, Derain, Matisse, of course, Cézanne, and so on. She also welcomed French poets like Apollinaire, for instance, and Marie Laurencin, and the Surrealist poets. But she really became like the godmother of the next generation of American writers who came in the 20s. And here I'm talking about Hemingway, Dos Passos, William, Carlos Williams, E.E. Cummings that you just quoted. Also, lesser-known poets as Anderson Sherwood and so on, and Fitzgerald, of course.
When you say that she was a godmother, do you mean that as just being the hostess of the salon, or was she a godmother also in terms of the aesthetic that she promoted herself?
That's a very good question. I think that the influence she had was that her salon was the place where all these writers created a community. And it's not that much that she herself was that influential, by her writings or her advice, like she discussed Hemingway's writings with him, but very soon he distanciated himself from her advices. But she was the person who gathered all this community together and also set the tone for an avant-garde mentality, I would say, and the idea or the motto almost to go beyond what's been done before in terms of forms and content.
Mm-hmm. And this raises the question that we want to explore a little bit about how much what was happening in France and in Paris in terms of the artistic literary movements had a direct influence on modern American literature of those writers who went to Paris. Certainly, it would seem that Gertrude Stein herself was very influenced by it. But we have to remember it was a very rich moment in European modernism. Paris being the real center of it, you have Fauvism, Cubism, Dada, Surrealism, and so forth. How much of these movements did Gertrude Stein herself actually appropriate and transform into her distinctive American avant-garde literary style?
I think that she consciously wanted to become a Cubist writer. So she took from Picasso, from her discussions with Picasso about his art, the concept that you have to get rid of a monolithic vision of an object or a situation and put flat on the table all the aspects of, for instance, a thing and describe it from different perspectives. And the other thing that is really determinant in her writing is the importance of form over content, over meaning also, and rationality. And that probably has been influenced by the Surrealist movement as well as Apollinaire, who started his calligrams and calligraphic poems just before World War One.
So she said there are three modernists. Yeah, so it was Picasso and...
Joyce
and Gertrude Stein.
Yes.
Yeah.
She forgot many.
Well... I would put Stravinsky in there too, because he was the other in music, the other great modernist. And I would not myself put Gertrude Stein in that company. In fact, I don't know where I would put her myself. So she is the godmother, and certainly the salon. And do the writers that come subsequently? Which I guess is in the 20s, no, after the First World War. In fact, many of them that came in the 20s had gone to Paris or to France originally during the First World War. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And that's one element of their sense of exile within American society when they came back from World War One. Dos Passos, E.E. Cummings, Hemingway... flew to Europe to serve as soldiers, and they arrived in 1917 and really experienced the worst of World War One, and then were kind of left adrift when they came back to the United States, having experienced something that they could not relate in so many words, and feeling this this distance within the country that was supposed to be home. So the desire to go back to Europe, which was the origin of their exile in the first place, and the destruction of their sense of the meaning of civilization, was probably this kind of pilgrimage to like the traumatic place of their sense of who they were to become.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take one at a time. Not all of them, obviously, because there's a whole profusion of people that we're not even probably going to even mention on this show who would fall into the category of American writers in Paris. But clearly some of the major figures. Hemingway is not someone that I would in any way associate with the avant-gardist aesthetics of Stein and her, the French avant-gardist movements, either literary or artistic. So he goes to Paris. I don't know how much he learns from, the French in that regard, but clearly he recalls those years that he spent in Paris in the 20s as, the happiest and the most creative of his life. But is it fair to say that he took his own baggage with him?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's a very interesting thing about the Americans writer that come to Paris is that for all of them, Paris is really the cradle of their birth as writers. And what Hemingway describing in A Movable Feast is really his working sessions in cafes and how he crafted his style. He has a whole ethics about the one true sentence that he has to start every paragraph with. So he fashions this persona of the new author learning the craft, but he adheres completely to the work ethics of, you know, American values, and he's extremely dismissive of the bohemian life of other American writers that hang out in cafes. He doesn't want any sexual promiscuity with the French. Actually, no intellectual promiscuity either, since he doesn't read any French book, really. He doesn't mingle with the surrealists or the French avant-garde. So Hemingway basically finds a heaven for his growth as a writer, but not a place where he would be transformed from the outside.
That's well put, yeah. And this learning the craft, and we know that Hemingway was a master of the short sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was alluding to in my opening remarks as giving a style to aphasia, if that's not putting it too dramatically, but very American in that regard, where one is at odds with this medium that's called language. One doesn't inhabit it in a serene way, but always in a nervous tension with its constraints. And part of the distinctive American style that you get in Hemingway, I think, is this undercurrent of ill-at-easeness there within the sentences themselves, no?
Absolutely, and he developed this theory of the iceberg in A Movable Feast, which says basically that to get a really good short story, you have to leave out the important part of the story. Yeah. And it's exactly what you said, that the very short sentence where you say less than what you want to say, and that's where the tension lies, basically, and that's what makes it eloquent. But you're completely right. I mean, Hemingway distanciated himself from Stein in that matter. And what's fascinating is that the most American literature was born in Paris in the 20th century.
Yeah. Was he on good terms with Stein?
Up to a certain point, he benefited from her patronage to get his ways in the world of Paris. But, I mean, almost all these writers, when they recollect their memories, try to surpass each other in the art of blaming others for not being the right writer in Paris. So Stein dismisses Joyce and Ezra Pound and as really ironic against them. And Hemingway does the same with Gertrude Stein in his own book. So they had a cold, I would say, at some point in their relationship.
Ezra Pound is a major presence there for a few years at least, no?
Mm-hmm. Yes, from he was already in London since 1912, I believe. And after World War I, he decided that London was dead intellectually, and that the only place in Europe where you could still save American literature from potential suicide was to go to Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So he stayed there from 1920 to 1924.
And he had his own kind of salon of sorts.
It was 70 rue Notre-Dame-des-Champs, so the same neighborhood of Montparnasse. And he set himself in the role of the nice uncle, I would say, who would invite. He was extremely kind to young writers and encouraging.
Very generous, yes.
Extremely generous of his time and his advice. But he would never really self-promote himself as a writer. He would always try to show off the furniture he was crafting himself in his little studio instead of showing his art, which is an interesting stance as a poet.
Yeah. Pound then subsequently leaves France for Italy, and Italy becomes his true, let's say, adopted homeland.
Yes.
And it's quite interesting because I know that T.S. Eliot, from what I understand, only spent about a year there in 1910, and yet was much more influenced by French literary modernist symbolism in particular, no?
Absolutely.
Whereas Pound, we had a show on Pound a few months ago with Marjorie Perloff, and she remarked that you read his cantos, you know, you have all sorts of traditions that are worked into it, you know, from the Chinese, you know, especially the Italian Dolce Si Nuovo, but strangely enough, you know, the French don't, there's not a big presence in Pound. I think he turned more to Italy than...
Yes, and classicism, in a way,
classicism,
almost.
Classicism, right. So Fitzgerald.
That's another one. Fitzgerald is a good example because you have, the positive side of Paris and the negative side of Paris. So if it was a heaven, it could be also hell for others and a place of doom and failure. And Fitzgerald, when he visited France, was already on the decline of his literary genius. And this is clearly as he's just depicted by Hemingway in A Movable Feast. He didn't really produce much when he was in France. He hated France, saying that it was not a good place to write, which is really the contrary to what Hemingway was thinking. He led the life, you know, the bohemian life, the nightlife, and dissipated his strengths, basically.
Yeah, he did that his whole life.
Yes.
What years was he there?
He arrived in 24 and stayed almost until the beginning of the 30s. And
yeah.
He traveled from Paris to the Riviera to Switzerland also.
Yeah, in fact, I was thinking of Tender is the Night, which is a novel that takes place in France. Paris is big then, the Riviera, and he seems to, at least in that novel, pretends to have a perfect command of French.
Yes, I'm not absolutely sure it was true. Yeah. The good thing about Tender is the Night, for the purpose of our topic, is that it really depicts the American community as this completely self-enclosed community that doesn't communicate with the French at all.
And was that the case, actually?
It was pretty much the case for the people like Hemingway and Fitzgerald in the 20s. It's completely different with Henry Miller in the 30s. And Gertrude Stein professed not to read French, although she was fluent in French. But she had this motto that French is an oral language and English is a written language.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another element that's really important, I think, for why they would leave the United States to become writers, is that immersed in the foreign language that they could not master and understand and be influenced by, that complete freedom to discover their own new forms.
Yeah.
They were not under the pressure of a literary tradition. They had, a complete free range of styles and forms in front of them.
Yeah. So did they spend a lot of time among themselves, these Americans in the cafes, and were they insulated? I mean, did they take their own American provinciality and actually perpetuate it in Paris by just... saying among themselves.
I do think so.
They did that, yeah.
Yeah, actually, there's a quote from this writer. Sinclair Lewis came to Paris in the 20s, too, but he was already really famous and authorized, and he was not well welcomed by the American community, and so he, in retaliation, described them as going to this Café Le Dôme, which is conveniently located at the intersection of Boulevard Montparnasse and Avenue Raspail, which actually looks like the crossing of 6th Avenue and 8th Street in New York, and where the waiters speak Americanese.
Mm.
So basically, he was caricaturing the American writers, speaking among themselves the same language, and reproducing, pretending to avoid standardization, but reduplicating another kind of standardization in Paris.
Yeah. So we have Gertrude Stein, who's the godmother. Then the 20s is a big moment, big generation. And then Henry Miller comes subsequently to that, no?
Absolutely. He comes in 1931.
Yeah.
And he comes completely isolated, as opposed to the crowd of American writers who actually talk to each other. Like Hemingway came because Sherwood Anderson told him this is the place to go, and he had letters of introduction to go to Gertrude Stein's salon. Henry Miller comes with $5 in his pocket. He's sent by his wife, who wants to get rid of him, and he spent the first 2 years in complete despair and poverty until he discovers the form of the book he's going to write, which is Tropic of Cancer. It's a completely different scene. It's the Depression. The American dollar is not anymore this passport to any kind of high life in Paris, which was the case in the 20s. And Henry Miller also reads the French. He reads everything from Rabelais to Villon and Proust and Hugo, which is also another contrast to the former generation.
Yeah. So he actually inhabits a different Paris. Is it Montparnasse as well? But his Paris is very seedy,
mm-hmm.
and it's a much darker, Rimbaudian Paris, if you like.
Yes, season in hell, absolutely.
I was looking for a quote that I got from your your course readings, but I'm not finding it here, where he's talking about how he can't even find the way to the horror district or something.
Yes.
I'll find it, but...
Yeah. The description of Paris, that's the other thing, is Paris should always be in quotation marks for these writers, because there is as many Paris as there are authors. And although Henry Miller lived in Montparnasse, in the exact same neighborhood as Hemingway and Fitzgerald, his description of Paris is completely different, and it seems that his Paris is this dark place of marginals and prostitutes. The leading metaphor in Tropic of Cancer is that of disease. Paris is this gigantic body or womb that expels excrements and sweat and blood, and all characters are outcasts or marginals. The dominant feelings are despair and alienation,
yeah,
and exhilaration out of that, because he found his way as a writer. And there's the force of life in decay itself, almost, for Henry Miller.
It's not the quote I was thinking of, but here's another one of his, where he says, "This Paris, to which I alone had the key, hardly lends itself to a tour, even with the best of intentions. It is a Paris that has to be lived, that has to be experienced each day in 1,000 different forms of torture. A Paris that grows inside you like a cancer, and grows until you are eaten away by it." So the Tropic of Cancer, I think, has some reference to this this cancer, which was a productive one, a creative one. It was a matrix.
Cancer is this can be seen as something very negative, but at the same time, it's expanding and growing and multiplying in all those different forms. And it's actually the form of the book itself, of Traffic in Cancer, which has no narrative, but expands in all different diversions. And what Henry Miller really embraced in his experience of Paris was the flow of life. But life in all its forms, high and low life, the bloody and the mystic. So there's this all-encompassing book that is produced out of it. And he also describes Paris as the cradle of all artificial birth.
Mm.
Like, this is this gigantic womb from which everything is macerated and reborn in different ways.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a Paris more in his own mind.
Absolutely.
Well, he arrived in Paris alone without introduction, but he didn't stay alone all the time, no, because he had a famous affair with another American writer, Anaïs Nin.
Absolutely.
Who was Anaïs Nin?
Well, Anaïs Nin is interesting because she's in between. She is born in France, actually, from a French father and a Venezuelan mother, and she is American, too. She lived in the United States from 7 to 24, and she was raised in New York schools. She decided to write in English. It's a very intentional choice. So she's an American writer from French descent, if you wish. What's interesting is that she arrived in the 20s with her husband, and first in her diaries described that she wants to be the perfect wife, and she hates the promiscuity that she finds in Paris and the sensuality. And then here she goes. In 1931, she meets Henry Miller, and they have this torrid affair that has been disclosed much, much later, in the 70s, after everybody died, basically. It was so scandalous. And she discovered herself as a writer and as a woman writer almost through sexuality with mm-hmm. Henry Miller.
This was discovered in the 70s through what sort of documentation?
Well, it's her diaries. Her diaries were published in 65, I believe. And she had edited them already, so it was already cut from almost half of what she had already written, and she left it in her will that the remainder would be disclosed after the death of her husband and after the death of her second husband.
Mm-hmm.
So that was much later. So it's just her full diary was disclosed after the primary protagonist of her life could not be affected anymore.
How long did their affair last?
Their physical affair lasted for 3 to 4 years, but then she switched to other leading intellectual figures, among them Antonin Artaud and the psychoanalyst Otto Rank.
Mm-hmm.
So she was much nurtured by strong intellectual minds.
I've tried to read her diaries. It's been years since I tried. I never got into them for some reason. Something about... I mean, you can't love everyone, obviously. Do you like her diaries?
Actually, I do. I do, just because you see the evolution of her. Well, first, you really see what it is to be an American woman in the 20s, coming from New York, with all these inhibitions you were talking about, and how she's refusing to adhere to what she calls French sensuality. But you see the temptation. Like, she keeps reading it, basically. And she's like, oh, it's so bad, so bad. And she keeps reading it. And then at some point, she just succumbs and really develops her talent once she fully embraces her more mature self, I would say. So in that sense, it's an interesting writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have a number of quotes of hers on that handout you gave to your students. I'm looking at some of them. This one strikes me as particularly American. I am at home in the marvelous, absolutely at home, the unknown, the mysterious, the exotic, the strange, the never lived before, the difficult. I am uncomfortable and paralyzed in the common. The common is unfamiliar to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas my experience of Paris, and I'm not talking about the 20s and things, but I think there's the wonder of Paris is the way in which the common is so marvelous. And the common is where everything is really happening, the everyday. And this opposition between the marvelous and the common is, you know, might be typically American, but I don't think it applies to the way the French live, you know, the wonder of the common day
absolutely.
In and day out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
but it's interesting in terms of, choosing to live abroad though, that, what you get wherever you live, if you live abroad, is this constant, overload of new sensations new perceptions just from being in a place that you don't know and being immersed in a language that you don't master either brings this alternation of the shattering of your identity and expansion of yourself because you discover all those new things.
Yeah, and I think it was Gertrude Stein who said that every writer needs two countries or two homelands, one where you're from and the other where you live.
Absolutely.
And it's only, and that the one where you live should not be your native.
Yeah, there's one where you belong from and you write about.
That you write about, yeah.
And you need and another place to be able to see that.
So in that sense, Paris was like the matrix for writing about America.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and America reveals itself at a distance, at this distance, whatever that distance is that separates America from Paris, that... one can see into the American soul things that maybe back home don't reveal themselves to the writer. Yeah,
yeah, it's particularly true for people who came after World War II, like James Baldwin, for instance.
Yeah, let's talk about James Baldwin. Because so there are also these African-American generation of writers. James Baldwin, Richard Wright as well.
Richard Wright first arrived. He was invited by Gertrude Stein.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he managed to get a passport to go to France and was welcomed with Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre. So this is this huge contrast. Right from the first step he takes in the city of Paris of having to fight to get a passport to get out of the United States and then being welcomed by the leading intellectuals of France when he arrives in France. So you have Richard Wright, and then James Baldwin arrives a couple years later. But this time he arrives completely alone and poor. And he stays for almost 10 years and discovers what is his American-ness by being in Paris. And he has this whole reflection about the fact that he's more distant from... Africans from Africa and Europeans than he is from a white American.
Mm.
And that being an expatriate is the American experience of being unrooted, uprooted, and alienated from any past. And that what he learns is that he shared a common history with the white Americans he thought he was fighting.
Yeah. That's interesting because I guess I was trying to suggest in my own words in my opening that the American soul is fundamentally expatriate, whether it leaves the home or not, and that the literal condition of being expatriate can reveal what is quintessentially American, you know, in the self. In fact, there's a quote here of Baldwin, which I think is interesting, where he says, it's almost in a spirit of disappointment or delusion. If I had any intimation that the self I was going to find would turn out to be the same self from which I had spent so much time in flight, I would have stayed home.
Yes, it's a great quote. It's from this book, Giovanni's Room, which is a novel which doesn't deal with the black condition, which was what expected from an African-American writer. What also James Baldwin really appreciated in his stay in Paris is that he was confronted to the real question of the self, not the self, black American, but just the self.
Yes.
And that he was liberated from the gaze of the others and how the look of the others defined himself at the core of his own intuition of who he was. And arriving in Paris, he was stripped bare of any social preconception of who he was and was confronted with the real question, who am I?
Right. Apart from all the identity politics that we are always, all that noise about it in America, you know, that where you're always being defined by a category rather than a self, no?
Yeah. And actually, I thought again about the quote you you had it in your introduction by E.E. Cummings about the humanness that you find in Paris and this universal quality of just being human beings.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it can be related to the famous universalism of the French who don't want to look into differences. And it's another source of problems, but maybe for Americans it can be really liberating to be looked at as just human beings and not a woman, a gay lesbian, African-American.
Yeah. Well, let me make a confession here, because a lot of people find that French universalism is something objectionable about it, that it's related to imperialist ambitions. So, I'm a big fan of French universalism, and that one has the sense. I always ask myself as an American when I go to Paris, why can't America not be like France, where everyone is a human being, first and foremost, and that the categorization is completely secondary, if not tertiary, or if not irrelevant.
Absolutely, yeah.
And where, especially, for example, the ex-colonized groups seem French first and foremost.
And that's what they say, actually.
And that's what they say. And being French doesn't mean necessarily being belong to a particular nation, but being having an allegiance to a certain idea that humanity is a universal.
Mm-hmm.
And you start with that as the given, and all the rest then becomes these sort of minor differences that add to the diversity and richness of, you know, the human community.
Absolutely.
So,
well, I'm not going to deny you since I am French.
Yeah,
I've been raised in this idea. But I think for James Baldwin, it was particularly liberating. Plus, if you think about
it... Did he learn French?
He did. He speaks really well French. We have interviews of him in French. Mm-hmm. He speaks really well French. And also for a writer, any limitations on your own identity is going to be a limitation of what you can write and how you can write. So this sense of getting back to the core question of the self is also getting back to the source of your inspiration and your originality as a writer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. He didn't write in French, however.
No.
He didn't. And this is also interesting. It confirms what you've been suggesting, which is that Paris was a place where Americans went to discover themselves as Americans and get a perspective on America. And that although they're expatriate, they never expatriate themselves in a truly radical sense. In the way that someone like Samuel Beckett expatriated himself by not only going to Paris, but expatriating himself linguistically and writing in a language which was not his native tongue. And neither was he just trying to become a French author. It wasn't that he was just trying to appropriate, but that he would write French in order to retain a certain foreignness, even in the linguistic idiom that he was writing. As he said, in order to avoid all the embedded clichés that come with your native tongue. So I think it would be interesting, it would have been interesting if some of these American writers had actually gone all the way and left us some interesting works in French.
Mm-hmm. I know only one, which is Julien Green, who really felt he was almost French and decided to write in French. But if you think about it, the Samuel Beckett's attitude is in a way not completely similar, but in both the American writer's attitude and Samuel Beckett's, you see this need to gain this distance and go beyond the norms and what is already, as you said, embedded in your head as what you should write. And Gertrude Stein and Hemingway and these and Henry Miller, who was extremely inventive in terms of forms, they did manage to go beyond the American language, even if they chose it as their written language.
They transformed it.
They
made it their own. They expanded its linguistic possibilities. But from Beckett's point of view, they never really left.
Mm-hmm.
Their homeland, insofar as they never left their, you know, the English as such. So, Cécile, we have a few other generations, at least one other generation that we want to talk about, and that's the Beat generation.
Yes.
Is that in the 60s? I don't know if it's in the 50s, 40s, 50s.
They arrive at the beginning of the 60s.
And we're talking here about Kerouac.
Absolutely, well, all of them. Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Burroughs, Corso, they all end up in this very small, shabby hotel, Neuf Rue Gilles Le Coeur in the 6th arrondissement, and don't go and try to find it because it didn't exist anymore, and it's now in a very rich neighborhood. But it was completely shabby. They had no money, basically. And they didn't spend time writing that much, I have to say. They experimented a lot more with substances than words and language. But what's interesting about them is that the whole Beat Generation movement seems to find its true habitat in a place like Paris, where there's this acceptance of the poet, of the poet maudit tradition, and they're reenacting 100 years afterwards what Rimbaud and Verlaine did in the same place.
Yeah.
And another thing that really struck me is that a number of these writers got published in Paris, even if it was in English, because their books would be forbidden in the United States.
Well, Henry Miller for sure.
Henry Miller for sure. And it was not after 30 years after the original print that it was published in the United States. But also Lolita, for instance, even if Nabokov didn't stay in Paris as such. But The Naked Lunch was also published in Paris before it could be published in the United States. And when the Beat poets were hanging out in Paris, they were hearing from the suit that the trial of Ferlinghetti, the San Francisco poet and publisher. He was sued because of the public performance of Hall by Ginsberg. And so there's this whole contrast between the either permissiveness of freedom that you find in Paris and the American constraint on thoughts and expression. And that's another element of the freedom they could find in Paris, too.
But you're saying that they spent more of their time doped out rather than...
Actual writing.
Or immersed in that.
Yeah.
And, of course, their heroes were, in many ways, the symbolists of Baudelaire and the poet maudit, Rimbaud.
And wanderers and nomads. Mm-hmm. Like they're really people traveling and traveling and traveling with no sense of home.
Sure. Well, this raises the whole question of the relations, you know, between France and America and how much America owes in terms of its inspiration to France, if not to Paris directly. And I mentioned earlier the founding fathers, I mean the framers of the Constitution, Jefferson and Franklin, who for whom there sojourn in Paris was so incredibly important in terms of their thinking about the essence of a republic, about what is a republic, and the Declaration of the Rights of Man, and the way there was, well, there was a mutual sort of influence there.
Mm-hmm. And admiration.
And admiration, because the French Revolution is actually subsequent to the American Revolution.
Absolutely.
In many ways, the American Revolution, which does have a strong component of French inspiration, then in turn becomes a model.
Mm-hmm.
Of inspiration, at least an inspiration in its own right for, you know, the French Revolution. And, of course, we have our Statue of Liberty and so forth. And it's something that continues,
yeah,
from what I gather, with writers that still, to this day, I think are going to Paris. In the ultra, something, it might be a little bit cliched now. I think it's a little bit overdone. I think probably the consummate end may be Jim Morrison,
mm-hmm,
who, when he got sick of being a pop star in America, you know, goes to Paris to be a poet, thinking that he's finally going to do what he always wanted to do, which is be taken seriously as a poet, not just a singer, and of course he. He dies in Paris in 71. He's still buried there in Père Lachaise.
But there's a whole cult on his tomb.
Exactly, yeah. But that seems to be almost a kind of end to. I wouldn't call it a myth, because it's far more than a myth. It's as real as you can get in terms of what American literature in the 20th century owes to you know, the Parisian influence and hospitality.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Hospitality in that sense, yeah. And it's typical also that they could go to Paris, that the part of the hospitality of Paris would be that the liberalism by which they, the Parisians would not, that Paris doesn't insist on colonizing anyone who comes there, that you can do what you want.
Yes,
you know?
It's either tolerance or indifference. That's
actually
Gertrude Stein, and up to this day, I know an American poet who comes back to Paris, and he's always amazed at how intellectuals are really admired and respected in France, in French culture at large, and have a place in society. And Gertrude Stein was saying that, was relating this little anecdote where she wanted to park in this garage, and the guy who managed the garage said, "Oh, yes, of course, you're a writer, you need a place." And so she got a parking slot when a politician next to her and a common day person would not have one.
That's my kind of place.
Yeah.
The poet first, the politician
last.
Last. You know, Cécile, someone listening to our program would naturally assume that you're that what we're talking about is your area of specialization, that you're you know, in modern French and the influence of France. But actually, we should tell our listeners that you're not at all in that field by formation.
Yes.
But you're both a medievalist and a Renaissance scholar. No.
Absolutely. It's the whole paradox. I was teaching American writers in Paris, although I am a Parisian expatriate in Stanford.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
I'm specializing in Renaissance poetry in particular. So, yes.
Yeah. And this is your third year here with us.
Yes, absolutely.
And what courses are you teaching now here?
I'm teaching an undergrad introduction to medieval and Renaissance literature called Authorship, Book Culture, and Nation Building in Medieval and Renaissance France. And it's a lot of fun.
Fantastic. We also congratulate you. You've been recently married, and you continues the theme of the Franco-American relations, because your husband is an American, not only an American, but he's also a musician.
Yes.
Jazz musician at that, and a composer. And I know that you brought in some of his music that we're going to end our show on. Can you tell us something about your husband and his and his music?
Yes. Well, so his name is Ken Berman, and you're going to listen to an as yet unreleased song called "It's Over," which is not about our relationship, but, but
it's about our show.
Our show today, probably, which is from a CD album to be released in April called In Mind. And he's a pianist and composer. And you lived with me in Paris in this fall, so we did continue the tradition of the American artist going to Paris for inspiration.
How did you like it?
He loved it. He loved it. And the jazz scene in Paris is really transcendent.
Yeah, that's another thing we haven't. We could talk about the jazz and the blues.
Yes,
And also
Saint-Germain culture. Yes, yeah. There's this whole other aspect of Paris.
Is he learning French?
We're trying.
Okay. So we're going to listen to a song called "It's Over" on a CD of his.
Yes, called "In Mind."
In Mind.
Yes, to be released in April by Ken Berman. Thank you very much.
So before we turn to that, thanks again for coming on, Cécile. Enjoyed it a lot. And I want to remind our listeners that we have a webpage for this program. If you log into the Stanford's French and Italian Department's homepage and click on Entitled Opinions, there you can access all our previous shows. There's about 30 of them, or close to 30 by now. You can also leave your comments. Look for our shows also in the iTunes store. And I don't know if we're going to be with you next week due to baseball, but we'll see. With the weather being what it is, we may well be with you next week. Otherwise, we'll be with you the week after that. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Thank you.